Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, available in theaters and on demand starting this Friday, May 11th. Jen is enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her silence, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent, revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film in theaters and on demand now.
Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. There's also the new Creepshow 2 collection featuring a wide assortment of shirts and enamel pins. They also have new Killer Clowns from Outer Space and Night of the Living Dead collections. So head to fright-rags.com now and you can enter the code SHOCK0118 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SHOCK0118. So head to fright-rags.com today.
Shockwaves would also like to give a big shout out and thank you to House of Mysterious Secrets. Be sure to visit them online at www.houseofmysteriousSecrets.com. Specializing in horror collectibles and horror merchandise, shirts, clothing, toys, soundtracks, comics, posters, and so much more. Fast and friendly service with new inventory added every week. In business since 2004. Check out their website now. Again, that's www.houseofmysteriousSecrets.com.
Okay, and welcome to episode 97 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Not wearing the same shirt as you. Almost.
It was almost
a double Fright Rags.
Fright Rags is too popular.
I know, they are too popular. Or we just have similar tastes.
Maybe I'll get changed after and we'll take a photo together.
Really?
Double the Fright Rags.
That's fine. You should stand on one side, I'll stand on the other, and then it'll be even.
Oh, we could do a Shining thing.
And it could be a private moment between you two.
It could be, yeah.
Also with us, Ryan Turek is here.
Hello.
Also wearing a Fright Rag shirt, I believe.
I am.
Yeah. Rebecca McKendry.
I'm not wearing Fright Rags.
No, but you're freshly tattooed.
Yes, I am. I got a tattoo today.
So she basically got the photo that we took with all of our friends at Texas Frightmare, and she got it tattooed on her forearm.
All of the faces right there. So,
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It didn't look like it. It looks like flowers.
No. It does kind of look like
flowers.
Way to
dispel that one.
It's everybody. No. It's flowers. It's actually a dinner plate pattern from when I was a kid. Like, I stared at these plates three times a day for like 18 years. And
God,
so,
damn, you're edgy.
I know. I'm still like,
I'm gonna take
everybody
a floral pattern for a
people
plate.
Kept writing on my Facebook, like, where are the skulls? And I was like, on my leg. So this is flowers, guys. So,
wow.
Yeah. So that was my day.
Hey, I'm going to get a special sofa pattern from the 70s couch that my parents
Somebody might sit on your back, though.
Well,
that's not right.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I actually might like that. I don't know.
Guys, this is getting crazy already.
Tattoo talk. Well, I think it's because we've been out of the studio for weeks now.
Yeah, two weeks.
Episodes all over the place, from Chattanooga to The Overlook to Texas Frightmare. But we are back in Los Angeles at the Blumhouse Productions Conference Room, freshly back and ready to rock and roll. I want to report back from Texas Frightmare and kind of talk about our experience there, because all four of us made it. And we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of panels, a lot of stuff we were doing.
Elric is choking.
Elric is dying.
He's having
Elric
a good time.
Get a water.
Was so excited.
Heimlich?
Yeah. Dude, you're coughing like I do.
Heinrich from Possession or
so he speaks out and speaks poetry.
It's the death of a podcaster live.
You're all right.
Dan LaCroix.
You're good. All right.
Becca's trying to kill me with a LaCroix.
Do I need to punch you in the stomach, please?
All right.
Stab
you. As you were.
I'll use my EpiPen on you. Don't test me.
Oh, my God.
As long as you go to the breastplate.
but I wanted to report back from Texas Frightmare, but I fully intended to do this for a Texas Frightmare show. And I, not that I forgot, but things get so hectic and you're kind of like trying to make sure that we're recording and kind of the whole live aspect. But, you know, we had posted a photo last year of us with a handful of people with the Shockwave shirts. And then this year we had like triple the amount, which is really wonderful. But it got me thinking, and last year, somebody at the center of that photo is a gentleman, an artist named Dustin Pace, who is no longer with us. Mm. And so I fully intended to dedicate our live one to him last week. And again, you get wrapped up in kind of the whole spirit of the convention, and it's a little hectic. And so I just wanted to correct that and dedicate this episode to Dustin.
Yeah.
Because again, it just, you know, it blows my mind that people listen to us at all. And part of the fun of going to some of these events is all of us individually talking to different people and getting their perspective on how they listen to the show, why they listen, and just starting a conversation with us because they listen every week. And so, you know, thank you to that. And again, I just wanted to shout out to Dustin Pace, who you are missed, and
very
we still remember
so.
You. So
nice. We should also give a shout out to Odin Art, who is our cosplayer.
All right,
pretty much.
And every year ups his game a little bit more of coming dressed like the Shocker. And this year he came in like his giant
head,
kind of like Lion King Broadway showish head.
Yeah,
made out of
Julie
foam.
Tamor would have been jealous.
Yeah, no. It was like
light
made out
eyes.
Of foam insulation with light up eyes. It was epic. Yeah. It was amazing.
Whatever happened to that head?
It ended up in the trash because
no,
he couldn't
but it looked
get
awesome.
It back in the car.
They hid it behind the trash can with the eyes glowing. And
it
just
was crazy.
So they're gonna like.
It was so cool.
It's the scene on Drive where the guy has the heart attack behind the thing.
Yeah.
I realized that we had just left it behind on the table and we were just grabbing all of our suitcases and heading upstairs.
Because we were like going to miss our
flight.
And
I looked behind and I just saw this head and a single tear.
Yeah.
He said he was going to come back for it, but then he's like, oh, I couldn't fit in my car.
Yeah.
Which is totally fine.
Yeah.
But it was very cool.
But how was the convention from your perspectives, guys? Because we all did panels and, you know, well, Elric, you came in the last hour.
Yeah. But boy, did
we
party.
It was really fast.
Yes.
Fast.
So much partying.
I didn't go full Udo. I said a little bit of that. You know.
Full Udo.
You mean you didn't go full Chattanooga?
One day we'll explain. Well, Chattanooga is not even a touch on Udo. Well, one day we'll explain what that really means.
We'll talk about Udo. But the whole experience, it's just always fantastic. I love Texas so much. The panels are always a blast. I did Katie Featherston, who is just lovely. We need to have her on
sometime.
She's a darling. She's just wonderful. Yeah. I loved her so much. And I did the Cenobite panel, which was just a trip, and I love being in that giant hall and looking out and seeing just those hundreds of people who are all just there cheering for horror. It's wonderful.
Are they taped anywhere?
Yes.
Yeah,
a lot of them.
Okay, good.
Have been popping up on YouTube.
So the Texas Frightmare Weekend YouTube page is starting to put up your panels.
Mm-hmm,
they
put up the Cenobite one.
Yeah,
the Saw one went up. I had a lot of fun because outside of the show, I flew in with Don Mancini, who was on the show, and so we knew each other a little bit, so we kept each other company at the airport as we both flew in together. But then when we flew back, it was pretty amazing because it was me and Don again. Becca was on our flight with Bausman, Darren Bausman.
Which I have to tell a story about in a sec.
Talk about the TSA thing first, because I have the punchline of that story.
So Darren and I, we're on the same flight, and we're going through TSA together and through security, and he's like right in front of me. And so we get through like that where they're like, you know, doing the x-ray on the bags, and they pull him aside, and he looks at me, and he goes, it's the fucking doll. Because he had Billy. He had the Saw doll.
Billy for photo ops, and he refused to check it. He refused to show. It was his carry-on.
And
Billy the doll from Saw.
Wow. And it still has all the animatronics and the motors inside. So when that shit gets x-rayed, it probably looks awful.
They saw it.
And so they pull him aside, and there's this woman, and she's like, sir, what is this? And he's trying to crack jokes with her. And he was like, it's the doll from Saw. Watch out. And she's like, surly TSA lady. She's having none of this.
None of it.
And she's just like, sir, why is this in your bag? And he's like, because I directed the movie. And he gets dead serious.
And she asked if it was dangerous, and he's like, well, it is the doll from Saw. And she was like, stone face.
Bausman,
is it dangerous though?
It was great.
Wow.
So
they let him on?
I took pictures of him getting searched.
So here's the best part. So I walk on the plane, Becca walks on, Don walks on, Bausman's in front of me. And he's trying to fit Billy into the upper compartment, and it won't fit. And so who comes to the rescue? Matthew Lillard stands up, and then Ethan Embry. And the three of them help him get Billy into the upper compartment.
Wow.
And I'm just kind of like laughing, like, I should go on Facebook Live right now, because this is ridiculous.
It's just crazy.
Because everybody was at the convention, and we were all on the same flight back.
Yeah.
So it was just, it's one of those things where you're just like, oh, God, what world is this that we live in?
It was just cool.
Moments before that, I saw Bausman join me for lunch.
Oh, yeah,
you
tell that part,
because
that's even funnier.
And it's since Ethan Embry and Matthew Lillard are there, we're all just kind of getting barbecue, and Ethan Embry was just kind of hanging out on his own, and Matthew Lillard went on his way, but Bousman and I are sitting there eating. We're just talking, shooting shit about business and stuff. And then he goes, "But you're on my flight, right?" And I go, "No." And he goes, "Oh shit, I'm going to be late." And he grabs everything and runs off because he just presumed I was on the same flight. I was like, "No, man,
that's pretty amazing.
I'm much later. That's but let's talk about Ethan Embry and his final form. I totally respect this dude. This dude went from can hardly wait, this timid looking cat, into survivalist 70s dad.
Yeah.
He's got these 70s glasses my dad used to have. Huh. He's chiseled. Huh. He's a badass.
Huh. Really?
So mad respect to Ethan Embry.
I didn't even notice that, like that he was all chiseled.
Oh,
now.
Big time. Yeah. Wow.
Well, that was Devil's Candy?
Yeah, but he was like heroin addict skinny and Devil's Candy. Like he was like kind of ripped, but he was definitely trim.
That was definitely a transformation.
It was like an Iggy Pop frame in Devil's Candy.
He's a dude, man.
Yeah. But I would say that it was a good time. It was great meeting so many fans, and meeting so many Halloween fans, and meeting so many Blumhouse fans, and meeting so many people I now know from Instagram. and the panels went great too. I think that the Jason Voorhees collection of
you had your hands full.
Had my hands full because we had all the surviving Jasons except for Derek Mears on stage, and it was just like cranky old Jasons, duking it out on stage. And I literally led the panel by saying, "I just want to create a reality show for Shudder." Yeah. I threw all these guys in a cabin and it was insane. Steve Dash had a heart attack.
Before,
the week before.
Yeah.
And yet he made it to the convention.
Oh my gosh.
I'm blanking.
Him and Kane were
verbally sparring. At one point, Kane said something to the effect like, "Yeah, I wish you had another heart attack or something."
Jesus Christ.
The entire audience went, "Ooh."
Yeah, you claim that it was all in fun, but like I walked in midway through and it seemed a little tense to me. I'm sorry. All those Jasons seemed like
they're a little edgy.
They were a little edgy, but once they got back behind the stage, they were all just like, "Ha ha ha, that was great. Okay, we had a good time." But I had a lot more fun, no disrespect to all my fellow Jasons. They were great. I had a greater time on Child's Play panel, which was a lot of fun because it was just everybody up on stage talking about the franchise. Donzo is terrific. Fiona was my first time meeting her, and I thought she was fantastic. And it was great because she found out she was going to be on our Purge television show in real time next to us because her table was right next to our table.
Yeah.
And she got the call right there on the spot when I was standing next to her. And she's like, "I just got a great job." And Mancini's like, "Yeah, she's going to be on your show." I was like, way.
That's
great.
Awesome.
So she's going to play a cult leader on the Purge TV show.
Oh, cool. Isn't there a Chucky show as well? Is that a new
show? Don is doing a series. Yeah, he's working on a series. But it was a great time. I mean, like, listen, I explained to, there were a couple other folks that were from Los Angeles that I saw were heading out to Texas Frightmare. And I think we all agreed that it was just like, the sense of camaraderie and the spirit of horror and the fandom really under all one roof is just such a good time. And Texas, where it's kind of distanced from the industry and distanced from Los Angeles, I felt this last year, but I certainly felt this again this year, where it's all about the pure love of horror and the world that we roam about it. So it's
people try to compare, like, "Oh, but is it better than Monster Blues?" And I'm like, dude, it's a totally different
it's
vibe.
It's a different vibe.
They're
different.
Both great in their own ways. And that's what I love about
it. You're not sleeping over at Monster Blues, so you're less of a captive audience. You know what I mean? You're not living it.
Yeah.
You're just there and then you leave.
And there were so many people that we've met at Texas Frightmare that I now consider to be my friends, like Shane and
back.
Michelle and
weird
Dustin.
Presence. It's so nice with people. You know?
And just, it's wonderful to see everybody there again each year.
Yeah.
So great fun. Hopefully we'll see you guys there next year. And it's definitely a great show and recommend going out to it. And you can find our panels on YouTube.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, quick shout out. We will not be talking too much about this, but a few months ago now, I talked about a film called Deadly Games, a cool kind of lost French movie that this company called Camera Obscura Film Distribution put out. And that company heard our show and not only offered to send copies of Deadly Games for the rest of my co-hosts, which are on their way, but they sent us a crap ton of films, like stacks of a lot of...
Yeah. We don't know the title of any of them.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm watching, but it's okay. Excited.
It's on the back cover.
I did recognize The Long Night of the Glass Dolls. That's the only cover. I was like, oh, I love that one.
Nice.
So hopefully we'll be kept in the next couple of months. You'll be hearing a lot of these new discoveries from us, including apparently the pig fucking movie that was mentioned on
the Joe Bob Briggs episode.
Joe Bob brought up. They're like, we put that out. We'll send you one.
I'm good.
Ryan got rid of his copy of that one. He's like, you guys can watch
it. I gave my extra to Becca.
I'm going to donate that one to Horror Trivia.
I got a plan. I'm going to put on the other Evil Dead t-shirt, and me and you are going to watch the pig fucking movie.
This is getting weird, guys.
Boom.
It's getting weird.
Sure. It's happening. We're doing this.
I like weird ideas. So sure.
Weird.
All
weird.
For it.
Weird.
Let's see. So much to talk about that we've seen in the intro.
Oh, yeah.
I'll kick it off. I went and saw Halloween 4. There was a big anniversary screening of that here in Los Angeles that our friend Brian Collins hosted at the Chinese 6. And, I like this movie. It's the first one that I saw in theaters as a kid. I remember the Fangoria that had Michael Myers in the front of it. I went with my friend Sean Clark, and we were sitting there, and a lot of the cast and crew were there. And I don't know, man. I'm very excited for the Blumhouse Halloween. Let me put it to you that way. because here's the thing. I appreciate it. I love the opening shot. Man, is this a goofy movie. Now that it's been 20 some odd years or whatever.
But still way better than 5.
It's pretty. Yeah, it's way better.
At least it feels like a whole world. Yeah.
It is fun. And I get the attempt to kind of continue from the original, but it's the beginning is kind of goofy. Really, it's the other actors that, like, when Ellie Cornell comes into the picture and Donald Pleasance, bless his soul, the stuff he says is so goofy, but man, does he believe it. Yeah. Like, he believes it every step of the way. And no matter what monologue you gave him, he always delivered.
So
that part of it, I really love. I mean, his mask is terrible. Like, Michael Myers looks terrible in that movie. And I know that they went back and forth between two different Myers guys, George Wilbur and Tom Morgan. Now I can kind of tell which one is which. But really, it's when you get to Daniel Harris and Ellie Cornell and their story, because they're both really, really terrific. And that's actually what I appreciate now in retrospect is how young Danielle was and how good she is for a child actor in it, and how she played off of Ellie Cornell's character, Rachel, who's still my favorite character from the franchise. Like, she's just such a great character.
Is she the cop's daughter? Or is that
That's Kathleen Kinmont's character. She's the stepsister who basically will do anything to protect her stepsister. And I mean, again, you're more conscious of it. I mean, it was fun with an audience, especially like kind of the beer belly rednecks that go and accidentally kill Ted Hollister. Like, I mean, there's like some fun stuff in there.
There's some towny shit in there.
But the Q&A after, they brought up Daniel Harris. But really, I was excited because the screenwriter was there, and he very rarely does appearances. And he was, what's his name again? I got to bring it up. But he was terrific. And some of the insight into kind of what he wrote, I would love to see his original script, because he really was a diehard Halloween fan. And so his original script opened with the end of 2, where you see how Donald Pleasance survives. Basically, a whole thing collapses on him, and then you see him running out in flames, and they retcon it, so it's like, well, he kind of could have survived that massive explosion. So there was that, and then the other great story that he brought up was, I guess, because Sheriff Meeker is such a great character, and I think somebody asked, did he ever die in any of your scripts? And he's like, actually, he did. There was a great fight between him and Michael in the basement, and it ended with him killing the sheriff and the house going up in flames, and that's why they go to the roof. Like, that, there was the whole set piece of them going on the roof was because there was nowhere else to go, and the house is on fire, and you know that whole thing is like, but money, had to cut it all out.
Yeah.
But so I thought that was really fascinating, getting to hear a lot of these little stories about what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Halloween 4 is fun, but yeah, man, bring on yours.
I've tried. and Brian Collins is very proud of the fact that I've turned around on 4. 4, I think, was rediscovered for me in that big box set.
Yeah.
And the big box set came out, and I just kind of watched them all in a row, and I said, you know what, Halloween 4 is not as bad as I made it out to be. 5 is still bad, though.
Yeah, 5 is terrible. Yeah. Anyway, slice it.
I want to hear you talk about this one because I was actually meant to be at the screening. I heard you were going at the last minute, I was told a little bit
too late.
I have
my computer pulled up, everybody, and right now I have the screen open on IMDb to a 1987 film called Anguish.
Which I talked about 3 months ago.
You did talk about 3 months ago, and I closed my ears because I didn't want to know anything about it.
It's a really good one.
But it is an incredible film.
Yes.
It is a revelation, this film. I want all of you to go out there on eBay and try to find it. A mutual friend of ours, had hosted a screening night up at his house and went like full bore on rolling out a meal that was themed to this film.
Was it birds and snails?
It was Italian food, and then there was eyes, all sorts of eye foods, you know, so everything was eye shaped, or, you know, it was really cool.
I actually showed the opening scene from this in my class this year as an example of kind of an anxiety inducing scene with the bird behind the hutch.
Oh, the bird behind the hutch.
Yeah.
Anyways, so jump into what it is. Zelda Rubinstein, Michael Lerner. Zelda Rubinstein plays kind of an overbearing mother, and Michael Lerner is an eye doctor, and he collects people's eyes for his mom, and there's a sinister purpose behind it. But there is a much larger twist that I will not reveal on this film that is part of this movie and makes it so unique. And I had a lot of people come to me after the screening and were like, Ryan, you got to find the rights to this and remake it. And I was like, I don't know if a film like this would survive today because of some very sensitive topics that are played out in the original film and would never survive today.
Mm-hmm.
Someone would have to have a radical revision of it.
Yeah. But let me tell you, I mean, it is how do you pronounce the director's name? Bigas?
Big-ass Luna.
Big-ass Luna?
If you're Australian, that's how you'd say it.
Writer and director. And it's a film that's just got plenty of tension and weird. There's a lot of absurdity to it. Mm-hmm. But that bird sequence you're talking about, there's a moment in the very beginning of the movie where Michael Lerner has his bird out, and the bird flies around the house, and Zelda Rubinstein's like, get the bird!
Get the bird! Did you get it?
And then the bird flies behind this hutch and is like, literally, the camera is between the hutch and the wall, and this bird is just sliding down. You see little claws trying to find purchase on the wall. And then they grab like a letter opener.
It's like a coat hanger or something.
It's like a letter opener, and he stabs into the back of the hutch to get to the bird and open the wood.
Uh-huh.
And you see the camera is positioned still behind the hutch, and you see this letter opener just skewer right through the back, right in front of this bird. And you're like, oh my God, they're going to kill this bird.
Yeah.
It's a real bird.
It is like, because the bird's struggling, and the whole scene, you're just like, oh my God, they're going to kill the bird. Kill the bird. And it's so tense. It's like an anxiety attack on screen.
And it certainly sets the tone for the intensity of the rest of the film. And again, I wish I could go into more details about it, but it's just best left going, you know, completely cold, not knowing too much about it. But look up the poster. It's got Zelda Rubinstein standing in front of a wall of eyes, and it says, "The eyes of the city are mine."
So that's only out on a DVD still?
I have a
Blue
DVD
Underground,
of it.
I think, put out a DVD of it, but it's out of print.
It's not too expensive because I bought it a couple of months ago, and I wouldn't have got it if it was more than like $35.
Yeah, and the what we watched it on is a German import Blu-ray.
Oh, so it exists. Okay.
Yeah. But please check this film out. It's one that's not discussed enough. I remember Roy Lee many, many years ago got the rights to it and was going to remake it, but that kind of fell by the wayside. But it is just like one of those horror gems. When you talk about Discovery, Elric, about Chasing the Dragon, I had this thrill.
Oh, yeah.
I sat there and I was just like, oh my God, this is fantastic.
And I only remember parts of it, so I was so bummed. I only found out about it like last minute. I was like, I really wanted to, though.
And I had known elements of it going in, but it didn't ruin anything for me, because once I knew the key components of it, I was like, I want to see how that plays out. Yeah. It stoked my curiosity even further, because even though I knew some big reveals, it's like, no, that doesn't add up for me. I don't know how that comes into play in this movie, and now I want to see how the filmmaker narratively pieced it all together. So
we got to look up and see if he did other horror films. I mean, I know he did a lot of other films, but I'm curious about him now.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Wonderful movie.
Nice.
Well, I'll start by discussing that on our Texas episode where we were discussing the scariest films that we'd ever seen, I mentioned this incredibly deep cut called Sounds of Silence from 1989, which at the time you could only get on VHS for the longest time. It's only been available on VHS. And then as soon as we did the episode, people started messaging me and said, it's on Amazon Prime now. So I rewatched it.
Really?
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime now.
Shit, I gotta add it.
So it is way zanier than I remember. This movie scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. And I will say, and some of our Shockwaves listeners watched it, and I've been talking with them in the fan group. It still has some like super creepy scenes, but it definitely, when you watch it on VHS, it's very dark. It's a creepy kid movie. So like creepy ghost kids, dark on VHS. But when I was watching it on Amazon Prime, it's just like broad daylight. So
but just to prove my point, Rob's now looking at a picture of Simon and Garfunkel. See, that happens every time. You cannot get around
Sounds
this.
Of Silence 1989. But yeah, it's also this zany soundtrack that I had completely forgotten about, but the soundtrack is pretty fucking bonkers. That said, it's still got a really spooky premise about a family that inherits an orphanage in Sweden and goes there with their deaf son, and only he can sense these kind of ghost kids. Like, there was a fire, it used to be an orphanage, and the thing burnt to the ground, and all the kids died inside, and he is the only one who can sense it. So, super low budget, super hard to find up until this right now. But yeah, it's still, if you're looking for deep, deep cuts and can be a little bit forgiving of the fact that it's now kind of a lot brighter than it used to be. It's still a fun little romp.
It's funny. I just found it on Amazon Prime, and now it's showing me all these other films I didn't realize were on Prime now. Zombie Nightmare with Tia Carrera.
Mausoleum's fun.
Yeah. Spontaneous Combustion.
Devil's Hand.
Whoa. The Bean. Mm-hmm. That Jesus. Is cool.
Okay. I met the lead of that once. The song.
Fun stuff on Amazon Prime.
Very random. Okay, one of the ones, I saw a couple great bonkers ones, but we'll get to that in a second. Again, talking about Revelations, even though I've seen this. Let's Scare Jessica to Death in 16 millimeter, and it was just one of my favorite horror films. This really, I've only seen it once on DVD and loved it, but this just like, it has all the things I look for in a horror film, that kind of eerie vibe. It also actually had a moment which was kind of scary, because like just when the vampire / ghostly character comes into frame, the film burned. And so everyone in the theater just gasped, because this is like a very rare print, and suddenly some of that print is no longer existing in front of your eyes.
No.
So it's just like, it was kind of crazy. And they luckily could fix it. There was a lot of Mike Williamson jokes in the background. Like Brian Collins was like, yo, they're calling Mike for help. This is what happens. And there's a lot of that going on behind us. But the film itself, it's again another film that is kind of just lost in the shuffle right now. You know, it's not on Blu-ray. Incredibly atmospheric, though, you know, and again, even the parts that don't work as well, and the sound design, the sound work of this film, beyond A, she has a lot of voiceover where you really get into her head, but the actual sound design goes from a classical score to, by the end, it's full goblin experimental sound design, and there's just lots of little images you'll never forget from this movie, including just this woman coming up wearing white out of the water, not all the way out, just her with her hands raised. That's the scariest part, because you don't see her face. What a good movie that film is.
You'll enjoy this. The director of Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl, who is a Wallingford, Connecticut resident, which is
I could see it all over that movie.
Exactly. It is all over that film. Yeah. And I would love to do a double feature of Let's Scare Jessica to Death and Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl.
I've never seen Sweet Sweet Lonely Girl.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's
on Shudder. But he relocated to a part of town where the house from Let's Scare Jessica to Death is. Not it's very close, and he sent me photos of it, and boy, is this place creepy.
Yeah, and it's still there, and I think it was up for sale, because I know another podcaster who was going there, like on tours and stuff. So yeah, it'd be what an amazing, and that would be an interesting
remake.
Does
it still have the actual like vineyard attached, or was it an orchard?
If that, who knows if they're even located the same
in the same location?
But it has got that. Yeah, it's just a kind of interesting build to it. But anyway, great movie, and hopefully one day the gods. I don't know. It's a company that I think deals have started going through again. So
it's Paramount.
Yeah.
Oh, Paramount.
That's John Hancock, the guy who started Jaws 2 and then was fired off Jaws 2.
Yeah. No.
For something to do with Roy Scheider's, what's the character? The wife character?
Issue. Gary, really?
I think there's some issue.
Is that the whole
story? He did like 2 weeks on it. I know that.
Yeah.
And then he got canned.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a house. We're looking at pictures of the house.
Well, Jaws 2 came out great, so there we go.
Okay. Oh, wow, that house is incredible.
Not as good as Jaws 4, but, you know.
Oh, Jesus.
Junkadoo. Don't forget, Junkadoo.
Junkaroo.
Okay,
Junkaroo.
That's the most obscure trivia reference.
We asked that question, and then we asked it again 2 weeks later.
The reggae dance party that Michael Caine goes to.
We asked it trivia, what is the reggae celebration that's happening in Jaws 4? And the answer was Junkaroo. And then 2 weeks later, Jared asked the question again, just because he's like, I bet you guys forgot it. And everybody got it wrong.
Everyone forgot it, but I'm committing it to memory now.
So now we all know it's Junkaroo. Kangaroo.
Great movie.
I'm making my way through some more Vinegar Syndrome titles, and here's one that I'd never even heard of called Blue Vengeance that they just put out, and it's from 1989 from a filmmaker named J. Christian Ingvordsen, and God, what to say? I mean, listen, you never know what you're going to get, especially with Vinegar Syndrome. So this is kind of, so apparently this guy had written and directed a bunch of movies in New York in the 80s, especially during the time when when you could make a VHS deal and kind of that business was thriving. And so this was his attempt at a very ambitious attempt at a horror movie, which he'd never done before. And so basically it's like this metalhead convicted killer named Mark Trex who escapes from an asylum right away and he fakes his death by killing a hitchhiker and taking one of his teeth out and putting it in his mouth and then setting everything ablaze. And basically he's stalking the members of an old metal band because I think it's because one of their songs he wants to like fulfill one of their songs, yeah. I guess that's what it is. And simultaneously, the guy that put him away, apparently it's been 10 years. And so the guy that put him away, which is the guy that wrote and directed the movie, is the detective who accidentally shot his partner. So he's got like that whole, basically it's a really ambitious script that feels like that 80s action movie sort of deal, yeah. Like with the conflicted cop. Like it's totally like The Seven and The First Power if they had no money to pull it off at all. And so that's the charm of it is that it's like, wow, they're trying really hard. And there is kind of a weird, like, I think it's my love and affection for New York City in that time period because they keep going back to a club, which they never say anywhere in the special features if this is it, but I am 99.9% sure it's CBGB's because I used to hang out at CB's. I played there several times. And just from the way the door is positioned and like even the bands like that play, because there's a bunch of like rock bands and stuff that play there. Because one of the witnesses is a photographer that's always taking pictures of bands or something like that. And so part of my affection immediately is because I think a lot of it takes place at CB's, like even the back room and stuff like that. And so this is a really bizarre metal serial killer movie of the lo-fi variety.
I'm in.
The thing is, like, I think there's still something
really
to it
charming.
That you might appreciate it. And you know, again, Vinegar is doing a really kick-ass. I mean, they restored this thing. I've been watching a lot of them. I think this is the one where the director's like, this looks better than it ever has. Because they scanned it as like a whole 4K thing, you know, 2K scan from the original negatives. But also, it's kind of neat. I haven't even made my way through all the features yet. There's an interview. Michael Gingold does an interview with the main guy on it, which is always nice. Because Michael's kind of obviously formerly of Fangoria, and he does a lot of stuff for Remorgue now, and now back at Fangoria. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of an expert when it comes to New York horror. Like, yeah, I think he's on the Basket Case Blu-ray as well, because he just, when it comes to New York locations and horror, he always kind of knows a lot about it. But I haven't even watched this yet. The co-writer there's an unreleased movie he made called The First Man, which is included in its entirety as a bonus feature, and it stars Heather Graham, Lisa Zane, Ted Raimi, Leslie Ann Warren. Kind of like, you know, so.
Oh my gosh.
I haven't gone to it yet, but for that alone, I'm kind of like, you know what? For these kind of weirdo movies, I like that Vinegar Syndrome is doing this whole package where, well, let's throw in this extra movie we guarantee you've never seen.
And they have the best covers, I think.
They do.
It always makes you want to buy it.
Yeah.
Sometimes regret it.
Yeah.
Sometimes not. Sometimes.
So Blue Vengeance is going to blow your mind.
Excellent.
Wait. I'll do this really quick, but I watched Nightmare Sisters, the Vinegar Syndrome.
Yes!
I'm watching that this week.
It's every bit as trashy as I remember it. I mean, I literally...
Oh, so you have seen it in the past.
I saw it when I was a kid.
Okay.
I saw it like on USA Up All Night, but it was a TV version, I think. And my TV's next to a very large picture window, and I live in a very small little townhouse community, and people could walk by down the courtyard and see immediately what I'm watching, you know? So I'm watching these scream queens get nerdy, and I'm like, oh, they're so cute. And then Razzle Dazzle, they're suddenly naked all the time.
And I was like, wasn't kidding you.
No, you weren't kidding me.
So
I just kind of slowly closed my picture window drapes and was just like, all right, I'm going to watch this like a perv. and it's very trashy, a lot of fun. So I followed that up. I had some time this weekend by myself and I put on a Rob G. Dread Uh-oh. Central Presents release.
Oh, no.
Terrifier.
Terrifier. Oh,
I opened up my curtains and said,
the word. Everyone will see Terrifier.
I'm going to let the light in.
Terrifier
began, and I slowly closed them back again because I looked like a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, Rob, I kind of went in going, I'm really going to hate this. I'm not going to have a pleasant experience. I'm just, it's just probably going to be a kind of lowbrow slasher movie. And I kind of liked it. I mean, like, it didn't.
Can we get that on the poster? I actually kind of liked it.
Well, no,
I mean, it just reminded me of the kind of sleazy shit I would discover on home video in like 1991. You know, yeah. the clown works. Art the clown is really fucking creepy. Huh. I like the girls. Like, I thought there's a turn in the movie I wish did not happen. Because from that point on, the film became less interesting to me. But, to give you a little bit of example, there's a really great moment where Art the Clown is getting beaten on. Like, he's getting beaten. And I'm like, wow, okay, this is really cool. And then he does something that you do not expect from a slasher. He pulls out a fucking gun and he shoots his attacker.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, all right, I'm paying attention. There's some interesting turns in this. That said, there's some really grisly shit that I don't know. Maybe in my like age of 41, I don't respond to as I did once when I was like 19. But kudos to the effects team for pulling off some of the really nasty bits in this movie. I mean, they're really nasty.
Which is the writer director? I have to give credit. So
it's Damien.
Damien Leone is known. He's primarily an effects artist. He's been writing, directing stuff, and so I think that's what stands out the most about this is because he comes from an effects background. He really focused on that, and there is a show-stopping kill midway through.
There is,
which, to be frank, really offended me the first time I saw it.
It's brutal.
But
it's
again, brutal. I think you're right. Like because my friend's kid is 16 and he's studying effects and he's like, dude, I can't wait to see Terrifier. Right. I heard about all this. And so I'm like, I get it. If I was your age, totally.
I would
that same kid was sitting behind me at Let's Scare Jessica to Death. I was really impressed by that.
He came and sat in on my class at USC a couple times.
He's ain't.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Yeah. Wait a minute. He's under the table. but as a film that, is finding its way out into the horror crowd, I'm seeing a lot of people's social media about it and talk about it on Instagram and Twitter and all that stuff. I think it's certainly effective. Narratively, I think it kind of loses its steam by the halfway point, and I kind of wish it maintained that inventiveness and ingenuity and maintain the kind of motor that you get through that first half. But like when he's sitting there menacing those two girls at the pizza place, I was just like, ugh, making my skin crawl.
It's tough for me to talk about this movie because obviously I'm biased in that I helped put it out. But it was actually I got to give credit to Uncle Creepy from Dread Central. This was his move. This was selected before I started my job. So it's not a Rob G.
Kudos to Uncle Creepy.
People know my tastes. It's a little on the too mean spirited side.
Yeah, it's very incredible.
But that said, I think Damien did an incredible job, especially with the effects. Mm-hmm. And I do got to give a lot of credit to David Thornton because, this Art the Clown character has existed in shorts and previous anthologies. And David Thornton plays Art and he's terrific. He really kind of embraces the whole madness of playing a quote-unquote horror icon. And so
All Hallows Eve, which is also directed by Damien.
That was an anthology.
That's an anthology.
Yeah. And so there's one segment in it that features the clown. It's a different actor who plays him.
Interesting.
But Terrifier was his attempt to take that character and that short and make a full-length feature. You don't really need to see the short to appreciate the full feature.
Listen,
I appreciate that.
They're doing it. I like the fact that they're doing it on a Hollywood level with the Conjuring movies, and like they're like spinning off characters and what like that, stuff like that. And I like that simmering behind the scenes on the kind of scrappy independent horror scene. There's someone who is finding their way and creating a little bit of a world. That's great.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's not going to be for everybody, and it was just borderline, you know, almost not for me. But at the end of the day, I was like, all right, I'm going to hold on to this one because there's some really gnarly shit in it, and I'm going to probably show it off to somebody at some point.
So, yeah. Very cool.
Nice. I'll talk about some of my titles that I picked up while we were at Texas Frightmare. So I went by the Seventh Booth and I got Beyond the Seventh Door.
Oh boy.
Sierra,
you listening or what?
That was such a trip.
I come for you soon. I get you. Don't worry.
Oh my God. He was like the most incompetent boyfriend ever. And I mean, I guess they weren't really dating. They just like had broken up. I couldn't really understand
the
relationship.
He was getting back into her heart.
He was a bit off to begin with. He's just, I mean, somebody said Tommy Wiseau.
It's very mixed with who's the killer from The Untouchables and in the remake of The Hills of Us.
Oh, you're talking about
Billy Drago.
Oh my God.
Exactly like a mixture of
It's kind of like a combination between the two, and he keeps taking his shirt off, which is, again, you're just like, I don't know how I feel about any of this. Completely incompetent person whatsoever. Like, there's one point where she's like almost drowning, and after this has been going on for 15 minutes, you see him go, oh wait, I think I have a rope. What the fuck? You brought one thing with you into this maze. Anyway, the whole setup, we've talked about it before, so I won't talk about it for very long, but it's pretty much, it's like Saw, if Saw was SOV.
Yeah.
It's two people are going to rob this rich guy and somehow end up in his basement torture maze where they have to do these traps and puzzles every room. But it's seriously the two most incompetent people ever, so it's not like they're figuring out the puzzles exactly as much as kind of happening upon the answers. But that said, it's definitely an interesting
watch it as a party.
I see a young Lee Whannell and James Wan renting this from a video store somewhere. We have to ask. I have to know if they've ever seen this film. Amazing.
Oh my God. So yeah, there was that. It's fun. I will definitely say it's fun. But then I also went by the Arrow booth and picked up the new Hellraiser box set that has 1, 2, 3 and this absolutely beautiful documentary. It's got tons of bonus features. There's a whole fourth disc that's just kind of like bonus
Leviathan
features.
I think it's called
Leviathan documentary. It's beautiful. So I watched 1 and 2, but the one I want to talk about is 3, because because 1 and 2 I have deep loves for, but they're just very dark movies.
Because like CD Cenobite heads,
three has always perplexed me because honestly it's my fave out of the entire series. Like I love 1, 2 is brutal and gets even more graphic, but I fucking love 3.
You love the charms of Monroe. If he walked up to you with a rose, it was like, hi,
Monroe.
He has such good boots, I do have to say. I don't like my favorite scene though is he's smoking a cigarette while having sex with
Monroe,
and he has his hand on both of her breasts, and the cigarette, like you can see the ash going down, and the whole time I'm like, it's gonna fall on her, it's gonna fall, and then it doesn't. But
your bird anxiety
and she's tied up yeah. No, that was a scene I remember when that specifically came out on VHS. I was like, I'm just going to cut right to that scene. Yeah, I need to see what this is all about.
It's crazy. So 3 for me is the fun Hellraiser. And apparently it was supposed to be a lot darker. It was, I watched the fantastic documentaries. It was written by Tony Randall, who directed 2. Yeah. And he was intended to direct 3, but he actually thought he was going to make it too dark and too bleak. And so they brought in Anthony Hickox to do it. And then it kind of became Hellraiser in a club. And Pinhead actually has like almost witty retorts in this, and it does get more fun where the Cenobites get almost ironic. I mean, they were always kind of ironic, but instead of just piercing nipples and tying leather to skin, it becomes much more of like, you now have CDs coming out of your head and things like that. And
Anthony Hickox did Waxworks, we should mention, and so in just by default he's that kind of filmmaker where he kind of goes for the fun horror.
And I remember now why I loved it so much as a kid was I totally wanted to live at this club. I mean, yeah, like J.P. Monroe is like, okay, but this club, I mean, like, it had great artwork. The music was good. I mean, the title track that they used was the Soup Dragons, which was okay. But I mean, the rest of the time they're playing like KMFDM and Motorhead.
Oh, yeah.
This fucking awesome club. And then they've got that fancy restaurant next door where all of J.P.'s like rose girls go to. And it was just like a great club. And he lived upstairs and really good artwork. And so I just wanted to be there. Really good artwork.
And his boots are so clean.
Yeah. So it was just, and this is the first one where we kind of get Pinhead's backstory, because it's the first one where we see Captain Elliot Spencer.
That part was the part that stayed with me.
Yeah, so it's just a fun film.
It is fun. And it's trash.
I will say, I wanted this film's ending to continue part four so bad, because in the ending, Terry Farrell, who's our lead, who I have total woman crush on when she was Jadzia Dax on Deep Space Nine. So at the end of the film, she puts the lament configuration box into a wet concrete. And then it kind of shows this time lapse, and this building has grown up around it. But the whole building, it's got lament configurations everywhere, and there's puzzle boxes on the floor. And that actually continued in the comics. There's a comic about the building that was actually designed after the lament configuration. And depending on how you walk down the walls, the hallways, you could actually open the box. And I wish they had kind of continued
that. Don't they do a little bit of it in Bloodline? I can't remember.
Not enough.
Because I know Bloodline is like four different stories, but I thought they did a slight continuation of the building.
I think there is a slight.
It's been so long,
I don't remember.
It's such, like, that ending is so cool, and you're like, oh my God, the building is a puzzle box. And then I don't remember going anywhere.
I mean, the spaceship was, wasn't it?
The spaceship turned into a puzzle box. Yeah, but that's Pinhead in space.
Speaking of which, I did forget, because we did just talk about Texas Frightmare, and even though I didn't do too much crazy stuff because I wasn't there long, I did have to thank Rob for making one of my weird dreams come true, which is, it sounds lame, but Clive Barker for me was actually more important for me than Stephen King, even though I love King's work. Mm-hmm. I grew up, it was like Barker's work that unlocked something in me in terms of the kind of darker dreams. And so Rob kind of talked to somebody, and one of our listeners, shout out to Freddie.
Freddie's girlfriend, and I kind of taking care of Clive for the
I got whisked at the very end of the festival into a private room, in a room where he's just with a couple people, and
I told you, be prepared. If it happens, it's going to be quick, and it's only going to be you.
And it was cool because most people kind of, you know, getting things signed, it was more about the signature, and I just kind of wanted to get real personal for just a second with him, and just, I literally just thanked him for his imagination and what that unlocked in me. And he, as I was walking away, looked up again and said, thank you for that. Like, it was really cool. Like, and sometimes, like, there's little moments, I know, where we meet so many people, and we're lucky that, like, listeners who probably, you know, dream of meeting some of these people, sometimes we don't take it all in, but meeting Romero at one point, just even a handshake, and this were probably two of those moments I'll you know, always kind of cherish. And he seemed in good form to me. Mm-hmm. You know, he was shaking hands and like smiling, and so that was super cool. So on the Barker front, that was really rich. So thanks for
Clive
making that happen. And then from serious to talking about part threes, here is your bonkers pick of the year, people. You will not want to turn off right now. Zombie 3.
Yes.
Holy fucking shit, man. This is a movie I'd never seen. I'd heard the stories. As I'll always say, I'll watch Fulci anywhere, anytime, even half-finished Fulci. But there are some amazing stories on this. Okay, for one, at first I wasn't sure what I was watching. Okay, it's like, you know, the weird moss from Jodie Verrill? It's like if you had the Jodie Verrill story, right, directed somewhat by Fulci, but also by the guy who did Troll 2. Because that's the aesthetic we're getting at parts of this movie.
Yes.
And then if suddenly it just became Birdemic for a while, that is basically this movie in a nutshell. It changes tones like wild. It basically, every 7 minutes you're watching a new movie, which is nice. It's like an anthology, basically. The opening was shot by Bruno Mattei. So first, the logistic story. This is a weird movie. Fulci directed about half of it, and what happened was he apparently, Fergasso really, who wrote it, tells the story that basically Fulci is a really old school director, and everything had to be prepared like precisely for him to make a movie he wanted to make, and the producers fucked him at the last minute and rushed it into production, and so he was really unhappy on the production. He always felt like they're behind, they couldn't get the things he wanted, and at a certain point he started getting a little sick, and then the producers wrapped production. Towards the end of production, he kind of had said behind the scenes he would get his revenge in some way. What his revenge ended up being is at the end he shot 40 minutes of people in a canoe, and when he showed the final cut, so it's this movie with all this action, then the movie would have been like 40 minutes long, and then there's 40 minutes of like canoe sequences of just characters canoeing, and apparently they were laughing because that was his revenge. It was like, fuck you, this is what you get for fucking me. And so of course, unfortunately, then the producers looked in and went, we're not releasing, this movie's way too short. And Bruno Mattei, who you guys look him up, he's directed literally 1,000 movies, he happened to be in the Philippines. So again, this is also like a Corman prison movie because it's shot in the Philippines, which only means bonkers. Like,
which also means Filipino zombies.
Oh my God. Filipino jumping out of trees, springing out of boxes. Yeah. They jump out of every little orifice. It's crazy. They really do. They do. They jump out of, no, literally.
Trust me.
There is a scene in this movie that where I'm being accurate. And so I guess he was going there to shoot a Richard Harris film, and they're like, well, you got time anyway. Can you shoot the rest of this movie? And he was good friends with Fulci, and Fulci gave his blessing. Fulci, unfortunately, was getting really bad. this is really, you know, a really bad stage for him. And so him and Fragasso had to rewrite this. And man, what you get this weird green light, almost like that Vertigo green light you get in a lot of sequences where I knew without knowing any of the story that I was watching the parts Fulci wasn't shooting because there was nothing like his aesthetic. Like it just felt kind of cheesy and cheap, kind of like Troll 2. but those parts are also really bonkers and fun. But and then there's moments where you're watching really a Fulci film where, I don't know, there's some really nice moments. There's a moment like where there's a bold zombie with a big blade just comes out and he's like trying to chop her. And it's like fucking scary for a beat. But this is like a virus outbreak movie. This is the line that I wrote down. One thing's for sure, the Death One compound is far more dangerous than any of us ever imagined. You're like, you called it the Death One compound, man. How did it not spread?
That's amazing.
But there is a sequence in here where it goes full birdemic. Like, yeah. And all these birds are going into thing.
Oh, it actually is birds. Yeah, like I thought you were using that as like a comparison for the zombies.
Yeah, basically there's a virus and that goes into a body. Then government decides to burn the body. And it's the burning of the body that releases it into nature. And then everything gets affected. And then the military scenes are terrible. And they're probably all Bruno Mattei stuff. There's guys in contamination suits. That's all Bruno Mattei stuff. That's okay. But as a whole, it's just so freaking crazy and fun. And there's two moments in it where they're like just two absolute like, holy fuck, like you'll fly back in your chair. They're so crazy. It's worth buying this just for these two moments. One is good pregnancy horror, which I'm always a fan of. And it's utterly, utterly crazy moment. And the other one is a head that does something. It's pretty wild. And yeah, I don't know. These are the kind of movies I live for. Like I need a couple of these a year to keep me excited. Just how you're talking about good movies. Like this is not a boring movie, which means it's a good movie.
Here's the funny thing. So Severin Films had put out the Blu-rays of this Zombie 3, Zombie 4.
I bought this one for so I'll watch for it for next week.
Yeah, sure. Zombie 3, Zombie 4, and Shocking Truth, aka Terminator 2. Yep. Shocking Truth.
Can't wait for that.
I'm trying to catch Zombie 4.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, but Severin years ago had put out a DVD box set of Zombie 3, 4, and Zombie 5, Killing Birds. Oh, shit. And so I went up to because if I buy the Blu-rays, I just get rid of my DVDs. So I went up to David Gregory from Severin, and I was like, "You got Zombie 2 as 3 and 4." I was like, "You're going to do Zombie 5, right? Killing Birds?" And he's like, "Well, I don't know about that one." And I'm just like, come on, man.
Yeah,
you're doing these on blue. You have to do Zombie 5. Yeah. And so, yeah, he was...
There's a lot of fun stuff. It's not... but nowhere near classic Fulci, of course, as a film. But it's I love that they finished this. I love that they put enough on this movie to make it an entertainment movie. And so, yeah, this is definitely... if you like your holy fucking shit, this satisfies, man. And the Filipino stuff does make all the difference because the way they're jumping around, it's like no... zombies you've really seen.
It's like they've never seen a zombie movie.
No.
And they hired these Filipino extras.
Yeah, and there's some just bizarre
be a monster
shit.
Or something. Yeah.
I love this kind of stuff, but you know, be prepared. Be warned if you're spending human money on it.
Anything else on your end?
I dug into the Scream Factory It's Alive collection.
Oh, cool.
So I watched It's Alive. It's Alive, I think, is my favorite Coen.
Really?
Movie. Yeah.
One of my favorite horror performances of all time, by the way.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. It's probably my favorite Larry Cohen just because even though I love Q to Death, I think the accessibility to It's Alive works so well, the relatability, because I think
it's very grounded for a horror film. Compared to all his other films.
Yeah, like the stuff is out there.
Yeah, everything's pretty over the top.
Q is out there.
The first 5 minutes, you meet John P. Ryan and his family, and his wife is going to have a baby. And
they're older, which I like, which means they're kind of scared of that.
Yes.
Like having a baby a little older. And that's
there's a rhythm to Cohen's dialogue. And I don't know if the actors most of the time are improvising, but there's a moment where he goes into the waiting room and he's hanging out with all these other expecting fathers.
Yeah.
And they're talking about themes that are playing into the film, but on a level that feels normal. It feels real. Like they're talking about, oh, there's so much lead in the water, and there's you know, we're thinking about all these chemicals we're injecting, and meanwhile there's a guy banging on the machine trying to get a Coke, you know, and John comes over and he's just like, "What are you doing? Like, let me hear. Yeah. Let me put a dollar in there. Go sit down, have a smoke, relax, you know?" And there's just like there's such a naturalism to everything that's in this film, and then there's the introduction of the monster baby.
An outrageous sequence, which is amazing.
It's
such
terrifying,
a good scene.
Yeah. Terrifying. But I did realize that rewatching it for whatever time I've seen this, how many times I've seen this, it does kind of fall into a problem with its narrative rhythm because it all gets contained to Davy's family house and where the baby has arrived. And it's just a lot of slow, meticulous creeping around, investigating, looking,
baby reacting, killer POV.
Baby killer POV, Shelly. Reacting to sounds. And this goes on for a while, and I feel that's where it kind of falters. But then it wraps up at the end really nicely. And I immediately started jumping in. I jumped into the sequel, and I'm going to reserve that for the next week. But again, you're dealing with characters who feel so natural.
The first two are, and then three is just utterly bonkers.
Yeah, I've got two and three to watch. Yeah. I got the box set as well.
Frederick Farce is the lead in the second one, I remember. But, but Ryan comes back into it. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
It's been a while, but I do like
one,
that film.
The third one has like this kind of weird AIDS allegory because it's like
send them to an island.
Yes. Because he's like trying to I just remember he's trying to have sex with some woman he picked up on the street, and she's like, ew, you're the man that had that baby. You're responsible. I don't want to touch you. I don't want you inside me. And you're like, fuck, man, that's heavy. Heavy. So there's a lot of great themes in this trilogy. And I think next to, when you talk about horror trilogy, is like kind of like off-kilter ones. You know, I always reach to The Omen, because The Omen is, I love Omen 1, 2, and 3, because as a collection, they work so well. It's Alive is probably next in line for me. It's like one of those series of films that doesn't get discussed enough, doesn't get analyzed enough.
Well, it's when you have the same author, that's how you can contain something. Yeah. You can really keep the consistency of the vision. Yeah. He's a really good writer. That's the one thing. Like, he's a good director and stuff, and he's always fun, but he's always been able to write. He can tell a story. You know? That's fun. Cool. Yeah.
So that's what I got.
I have two more super quick ones that I'll drop. I watched Rockula, which is now on Amazon Prime.
Did somebody watch Rockula already?
She watched Rockula. This is our second time.
This is my second time watching Rockula. That's why I said I'd breeze through it. It's on Amazon Prime. If you want to see Dean Cameron rap and Bo Diddley in spandex, there you go. it's kind of a fun movie. Yeah, I mean, the music sucks. I can't say that the plot makes a lot of sense, but it's fun. But then I'm going to mention this one because I'm hoping that somebody will watch it and then message me on Twitter or find me on our the fan group, because I really want to talk about it with somebody. Altered Hours, which is also on Amazon. I don't think it's Prime. I think I paid like $3 for it. It's from 2016, and it's listed as sci-fi. So sorry if this isn't hard enough for people. But it is so low budget, but it's such a cool premise. I'm not as fond as where it went in the third act, but the first two, I was so into this, thinking that I'd found this incredible gem. It's about a junkie who can't sleep because he had this kind of past event that you don't find out what it is yet, but he had this horrible event in his life and he can't sleep now, and he has to take hardcore drugs to get to sleep. And he eventually, his dealer turns him on to this new drug called Z. And the dealer's kind of like, I don't know where I got it from. This guy, chemist, makes it. I don't know, but he says it's like really good for sleeping. And he starts using it and he can sleep like crazy, but he starts flashing to the future. So he'll suddenly get these flashes where he sees himself in future situations. So he will flash to just a couple days in the future. And some of the flashes start getting really twisted to the point of him being in a police precinct being questioned for kidnapping the girl across the street, who's like a little girl. And so he has to keep doing the drug to see what's going to happen. But every time he does the drug, he forgets what he was doing during the drug. And so it gets really trippy and time travel-y at the same time. And then the dealer's girlfriend becomes a really pivotal character as well. Great freaking premise. It went on way too long. The movie was almost 2 hours long. If this had been like a tight like 80, this would have been like my find of the year. But that said, I really like the premise and I really like the first two acts. I was not as fond as where it went. But yeah, if you're into sci-fi kind of time crimesy-ish stuff, this was a really fun watch.
Altered Hours.
Altered Hours. Yes.
My last thing, I am going to eat some of my own words. I always think that at Texas Frightmare, I was fortunate enough to host the Arrow video panel with Ewan and Louise and that whole crew, and we had a great chat. I've always been curious about how their business model works and differs from the companies that we talk to, like Scream Factory and Severn, etc. And so that was a lot of fun. I got to take home the Region B version of The Thing, which, again, quite frankly, I was like, well, it's kind of redundant. I already have the Scream Factory one, and it looks great. It's got all the features. I don't need the Region B one. But I got it, and I'm a little biased because the guy that did the new features is a guy named Daniel Griffith, who's an excellent documentary filmmaker. He had done the documentary that's on From a Whisper to a Scream, which is one of my all-time favorites.
He went to Ronda this year for the Suspiria doc, which both Rob and I are on.
Which he definitely deserved, and the Donnie Darko doc, which I was fortunate to be a part of. And so he did new features for this, and I remember just teasing him, like, well, what else? How are you going to top the Scream Factory one? And he's like, by doing a complete 180 and not doing what they did at all. And so he did two featurettes on here. The first one's called, and actually it's they're all like, first one's almost full length, and it's called Who Goes There in Search of the Thing. Right. And what's cool about this is it goes back to the original short story and tracks the history of how basically every iteration of the Thing, starting from the original short story through the the Howard Hawks movie, through John Carpenter adapting it, etc. And so I thought that was fascinating, including the inspiration from the original author, who I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but he was just saying that when he was a young kid, his mom was a twin. And so it was the idea of when his aunt would come into the room and realizing it's not his mom. Mm. And that was kind of the kernel of the idea that inspired the original Thing. Hmm. And so I was completely fascinated by how that story evolved over the course of, you know, all those years from, you know, story to film to remake, etc. So that was great. And then the second feature he did on there is called 1982, One Amazing Summer. And it literally tracks everything that came out in 1982 from, you know, all these journalists and film fans and stuff, because it was kind of a ridiculously incredible year, including E.T., which was the movie that kind of killed the Thing in the sense that that was the alien movie everybody wanted to go see. And the transfer, I didn't think you could get better than the Scream Factory one because Dean Cundey approved that, but apparently Dean Cundey and John Carpenter approved the Arrow one, which is a 4K scan.
Oh, shit.
And it actually does look pretty fucking amazing. Like, flawless. So it actually, it's very close, but I think they might have a tiny, tiny, tiny better transfer. I'm happy to own both. Yeah, so there you go.
I have both. I have to crack that one open.
Yeah, I think, and I think starting with those features, you'll be pleasantly surprised how fun they are.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah. So there you go. The Thing from Arrow.
There's one last one I want to mention because our guests don't mind waiting. I can look them in the eye when I say that. This movie, I have to mention it. It's another Severin film, and it just kind of literally blew my socks off. That's Threads. Caught up to it. This movie blew.
Why do we have to end on this one, Kane?
Because the world will end.
Rockula?
maybe it connects a little bit to Endless in some ways. This movie is like truly an amazing piece of work. It feels like you're watching this. I'm just watching a BBC or a Ken Loach movie, and then suddenly the nuke lands, and you watch every thread. The title's literally about the different threads that hold society together and how we work as we function, and then each one of those threads is severed, and you're just watching the breakdown of society. And it sounds bleak, and it is bleak and depressing, but the way it is put together as a movie, this is a movie. I avoided this for years because, I mean, A, it was hard to get, but you could see it on things like YouTube, but I didn't realize it was a movie. I thought it was going to be like a faux documentary, and there's a couple elements like that, but this is a narrative, and it's really, you know, starts with a young guy who knocks up his girlfriend, and then they're kind of making plans together and things aren't going that well. And then the backdrop is that, you know, things in Iran and Russia, interference in America. Of course, as soon as I ended it, I turned on the news and the exact same story was unfolding. It was actually kind of unbelievable. What it builds towards as it starts going into the actual chaos, the way it uses fragments to construct a visual picture, like it will show, you know, one person over here, one person here, just close-ups and shots that make it suddenly look like it had a $10 million budget to destroy the planet, where in fact, it's just really smart, independent filmmaking. I really can't. This is like one of the best films I've seen in a very long time. It just, you have to go in with that warning that it's bleak as fuck and it might depress you. But what is mind-blowing and earth-shattering to my mind after watching this movie, I'm like, okay, I bet this guy didn't make any other movies. He must have just worked for the BBC and made this one bleak vision.
Are you going to tell me that he followed it up with a Benji movie or something?
He made L.A. Story, The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston.
What?
And Clean Slate, the crazy Garf, Dana Carvey private detective movie with the dog with depth perception problems. Love that movie. Anyway, he made those movies story. And Volcano. So Volcano is the only one that makes sense.
Yeah.
But everything else in between, I was like, L.A. Story? That guy, like, who, you know, destroyed
Volcano's
England?
Bleak as fuck, man.
Oh, no, Volcano, and that makes sense. You know, like, they actually kind of paired together. Wow. But this movie is worth a risk, and I think for horror fans, I mean, look, it's one of those ones where you're like, hey, if movies could save the world, if every world leader watched this, they would be scared as fuck, because the way it shows the destruction of the human body and time, and the one thing it does better than any of the other kind of nuclear fear films like The Day After, a lot of them to me are quite weak because it does the winter, is it called the winter solstice, the thing that happens to the planet.
Nuclear winter.
It really starts documenting that part, and when you get to that part, it's like even after the main destruction's over, you just really see how bleak it is, what it does to people on the planet.
Yeah.
Man, it's such an interesting movie, and I'm genuinely surprised how good a movie it is. So that's really what I'm trying to tell people who are on the fence thinking it's some scare tactic Mondo documentary. It's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. It's a real deal film.
Yeah.
So with that bleak thing,
good times.
Good job.
Well, let's bring on a real fun duo.
After
we'll be right back.
Our sponsors.
Fun? All right. Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, available in theaters and on demand starting this Friday, May 11th. Jen is enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her silence, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent, revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film in theaters and on demand now.
Shockwaves is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection featuring incredible t-shirts and a sliding chainsaw enamel pin. There's also the new Creepshow 2 collection featuring a wide assortment of shirts and enamel pins. They also have new Killer Clowns from Outer Space and Night of the Living Dead collections. So head to fright-rags.com now and you can enter the code SHOCK0118 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SHOCK0118. So head to fright-rags.com today.
Shockwaves would also like to give a big shout out and thank you to House of Mysterious Secrets. Be sure to visit them online at www.houseofmysterioussecrets.com. Specializing in horror collectibles and horror merchandise, shirts, clothing, toys, soundtracks, comics, posters, and so much more. Fast and friendly service with new inventory added every week. In business since 2004. Check out their website now. Again, that's www.houseofmysterioussecrets.com. Hey guys, welcome back to Shockwaves. So we are here with some fine gents who have been on our prior show, Killer POV, a number of times, but had never been on Shockwaves, and they have a film coming out. So Justin Benson, Aaron Moorhead, welcome to Shockwaves.
What's up, dudes?
Hey.
Hey.
How's it going? I'm like, it's just a tangential thing. I'm looking at Becca's arm, and it looks like she's scarred in a burn kind of way.
Mm-hmm. It, well, technically, it is a scar in a burn kind of way.
Well, it just looks like you're like from fucking Bad Dreams or something.
It burns.
So.
I got a tattoo today.
Gentlemen, you just got done doing a little bit of traveling for The Endless.
Yeah, can you tell?
How many?
On our faces?
Yeah, a little bit. You look a little weathered
spaced
and
out.
World-weary.
We were with them in Chattanooga.
Wait a minute, what?
They weren't there. Dave Lawson was there.
Lawson.
He drank the whole weekend. I don't think he stopped the whole weekend.
Yeah, he told us about it, and I was kind of surprised he had anything to say, that he remembered any of it.
Oh my God. How many weeks were you guys away touring with the film?
Well,
it feels like it was in stages.
That's the thing. The film came out at Tribeca in 2017, which is April, and then it never completely stopped until the release of the film. And then when the film released, we traveled for the release of the film.
Got it.
I was there. I was at that screening.
I'm curious when you guys you guys have been on the tour for films, for all three of your films.
Yeah, Resolution and Spring as well, right? Yeah.
And what do you, as filmmakers, what do you learn from the experience? You know, obviously you're getting to see these beautiful you know, beautiful parts of the world. You're seeing a lot of fans. You're meeting a lot of people at these festivals. But for you as filmmakers, is there anything that you take away from these trips that you that kind of help inform you guys going forward creatively?
Our first movie, we'd oftentimes walk in the theater and there would be like two people there. And now with our third movie, with the same amount of promotion at any given film festival, it's typically a full theater.
Yeah.
That's a really neat thing to see your audience grow literally all around the world. So there's that. Now when we tour with stuff, like this time, it's like while we're doing it, we've got two TV shows and three or four movies in development. So it's a weird thing where it's like when you're home, you're in this mad dash to get so much stuff done. And right. then you get on an airplane. Hopefully you got that stuff done. And then you go be jet lagged for like 4 days.
Yeah.
And then come back home and do another mad dash to get more work done.
Yeah. Is there any level of productivity done when you're on tour?
Normally, there's the things that happen aren't sitting down and writing. On occasion, you'll actually still have to do it.
Yeah.
But that we try very hard to avoid even being in that situation.
I have problems writing in hotel rooms. It's like my cheese off. Do you guys have like creative problems when you're on tour?
I hate doing creative stuff with Justin.
Your cheese is off. Oh, it's like your cheese. Yeah.
I thought you said a cheese off.
Yeah, I know.
Competition in Virginia. I don't know what
cheese is whatever it is that is. Like my creative energy when I'm at home,
yeah, okay.
If I'm trying to do the same type of stuff in like the Hyatt, it just doesn't feel right.
The work is bad for sure. But that said though, putting us on a plane or in a bar or a social situation together, especially in a place that is probably kind of at least novel, if not beautiful, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But normally it's both. That's actually where a lot of fun creative work gets done. It definitely gets, I think we've had some of our most illuminating conversations not in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
But if it comes to, you know, writing a treatment or something or whatever we have to do, that's just not a good idea.
Well, did spring kind of stem from traveling for Resolution? Because it just feels like, or was that an idea that was already percolating for a while?
That script was written while we were mixing Resolution, and when we were mixing Resolution, I was unemployed / table busser / PA, and Aaron was employed as a DP, but we
well,
were not
freelance, so you lose your job every few days.
We,
you know,
we were not in the privileged situation to be able to travel with anything, so it was kind of written in a it was literally written in a tiny apartment in Los Feliz. I'm going to stretch my arms. It was about this big.
Mm. That's not really an exaggeration. It is quite literally the smallest place I've ever seen someone live in.
Jesus.
So it's more like an escape fantasy that you were writing for yourselves, in a sense.
Yes, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that'll be $50.
But when you talk about like what we learn on it, there's it's like four or five or six different things where, you know, let's just call it what it is. It's really fun.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I'm not going to be like, yeah, it's just work. And, you know, I mean, it's really fun to go to film festivals and get to show your film to everybody. And then another thing is by interacting with people that liked the film, you can either make new friends. That's how all of my friends now exist. You know? and you can you make new friends, or at the very, very least, people continue to follow your work, and you do get to grow an audience. And we wouldn't have nearly the admittedly small independent film career we have, but it still would be even smaller if we didn't have some level of interaction. Mm-hmm. You know. And then there's the little stuff where, you know, getting to travel the world does definitely filter down into your projects and even your worldview, for sure. And then there's a really, really pragmatic reason, which is when you have a small film, there is never going to be a budget for a billboard, much less billboards, commercials, bus stops, that sort of stuff. So the best that you can do is go to these festivals that are more than happy to try to promote your film, and you know, the press will also show up and all of that. Mm. And it's the only way that you can use besides direct marketing on Twitter, where you're like, hey guys, go see my movie. It's one of the best ways that you can actually support your film. Film festivals basically made it so that people know
who we are at all.
Yeah. Can you talk about, well, kind of the evolution of the, your filmography is fascinating, but at the same time, how The Endless came to be, because, you know, Resolution was kind of what I consider a really cool word of mouth independent horror movie, where even we started hearing about, like, oh, you have to check this movie out. And then Spring was kind of a jump forward, obviously, because of Drafthouse's involvement. But with The Endless, I think when we were in Chattanooga, Dave Lawson, your producer, had told us that there were just so many other projects that you were all collectively working on, bigger projects, but none of them were going yet. And so The Endless was kind of your answer to that, was like, well, we need to just make something in the meantime while we're waiting for all this other stuff. So is that fairly accurate, or you know, how did The Endless become your third film?
So when we made Resolution, obviously we had no career at all whatsoever as directors. And that movie was made by bussing tables, waiting tables, working as a PA, saving up $20,000 and just going out and shooting a movie with our friends. Spring, we thought that would like allow us to make something like Spring, but it didn't. We had to self-finance that one as well. And after Spring, we had even more. There were actually a lot of opportunities. They just take longer. And now all those things are moving really quickly. But in the meantime, we just kind of felt like we were becoming meeting takers and not filmmakers anymore. So we just, The Endless was engineered to be a totally self-reliant project. We saved up money working side jobs to finance it. But when we proposed to actually Dave Lawson, our producer, of doing it that way, he was just kind of like, screw you guys. Like, you're going to save up enough money to pay me and the whole crew too. We're not going to do another favor movie. So, we actually went out and we tried to find financing for this one. And at the time we decided to do that, someone reached out to me on Reddit and said, hey, I'm just a fan of your work, and we're managing a film fund, and we'd like to invest in this new movie you have.
What?
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. So, and awesome. It actually worked out. The money was in the bank like 3 days later.
Every listener is going to Reddit right now.
Yeah, I know. Start promoting your films on Reddit. But,
so it's interesting because The Endless was engineered to be totally self-reliant, just something where it's like nothing can stop us from doing this. We're even going to act in it. So the actors, don't worry about the actors dropping out. We're just going to do it. But it ended up being our first film that an investor came on board. So
yeah, it's definitely our weirdest film, and it was the one that was meant to be as, you know, deliberately specific and somehow I would say it might be on paper until it exists. Right. It might sound like our least marketable film. Once you see the movie, you're like, oh, this is a sci-fi movie. I like this, you know, but. But somehow it's the one that actually attracted it. But it's weird that we had realized that we had made a mistake after Spring, not just doing The Endless earlier. Really, I mean, because we were chasing a carrot, and it's odd, kind of coming to terms with that, because there's a bit of an investor's fallacy in it too, where it's like, well, maybe one of these is going to go like next week, or like, you know, maybe it's just about just as soon as Ryan Gosling reads the script, he's going to say yes or whatever, you know, and maybe, and then we won't be doing this small movie that might not turn out well, and it'll be really embarrassing if it doesn't, And we realized we had to just kind of like swallow that mistake and just be like, go make a movie, go make one no matter what. And we'll never make that mistake again.
Yeah. Mm. Talk a little bit about acting in it, because Lawson told me he made you guys audition.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't sound so great. Forceful as that, but it was.
It was
hey guys, can I come on over and just like watch a scene or two, and just make sure. just make sure.
Did either of you have any doubts on that? Like in terms, of, I mean, obviously you're full of self-doubt, but did you actually doubt whether you could pull off a whole film?
You never know. In terms of like specifically Lawson making us audition, and very seriously, it wasn't a joke. We had already been rehearsing it for like 6 weeks or something, and had worked out a lot of the scenes. And what he saw, we actually shot that. And if you see what he saw, it's basically as it is in the film.
Actually, in the behind the scenes, which actually I think will be released on the Blu-ray, there is we shot those scenes.
Oh, and he made you tape them. Your auditions?
Yeah. Well, no. I wanted to.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to be able to see it too. You know, and so we actually were able to cut it together, and it's shocking how similar the performance stayed. even though one of them is in the middle of the day in his apartment with the wrong eye lines and everything, and one of them's, you know, in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. He made us audition.
Do you remember what scene was it?
We did two of them, yeah. Three of them. We did the monologues to the therapist.
Mm-hmm.
We did the scene where we're in the bunk beds talking about the definition of pedophilia. and we did the scene in which it's a spoiler. Are we talking spoilers?
No, no, spoilers.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, no spoilers.
It's a spoiler to hold off. Yeah. But those are pretty solid scenes to do.
Yeah, one was like kind of funny, but shows the dynamic. One's is, you know, as heavy as possible. And then, again, spoilers, but the third one was also as heavy as possible.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you find that experience, I mean, juggling a production and juggling the acting and juggling making sure that, you know, your narrative is in check. I mean, like, did you guys find that a daunting task? Or was it just kind of something that you just took day by day?
Well, it was the third movie that we had written, directed, done the visual effects, right. Edited, produced. We weren't doing craft services on this one.
But your dad was, though.
My dad was. So the hat we added was being a performer within the film. And the thing we both found was that, you know, acting is like everything else on set, really, really, really hard. Being a gaffer is hard. Being a grip's hard. Being a PA is hard. Everything's hard on set, including acting. But acting in a scene that you're directing is slightly easier in some ways because you're literally closer. You're not sitting on the monitor, like trying to focus and catch little details. You're literally right there with everybody. And you're in the same sort of state of mind as the other performers. So when you're giving adjustments and giving feedback, it just comes much faster.
Yeah.
I think if we didn't have a very high degree of trust in our collaborators, like my operator, Will Sampson, for example, if I didn't know that he just got it, then yeah, that would be highly stressful. But the good news is we've worked together so much that he understands my taste and vice versa. Yeah. And so, yeah, it actually turned out to be something that was shockingly smooth. Also thanks to Dave Lawson.
Well, did you enjoy it? I mean, did you enjoy performing? I mean, if you stripped away all the other duties that you guys had to do on set, would you jump into another acting role?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. See, it's something that's really gratifying, and just also see it as something that's a huge privilege. If you've
well, also helps that you guys are handsome.
go on, Ryan. This is Ryan Turek. Ryan Turek calling someone handsome.
I was thinking it, but I wasn't going to go there.
I was getting ahead.
Holding it back.
go ahead, Rob.
No, I'm looking at the back of the disc right here, which comes out officially June 26th. But there is an extra that is titled Ridiculous Extras.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them.
Can we reveal what Ridiculous Extras is?
We'll have to remember them, but yes, exclusive on the Shockwave. So what it is in Resolution, we always turn in so many things for the disc that they have to cut them. They just don't fit on Blu-rays and DVDs. And Resolution is the best example where they just have the most insane stuff we could come up with, where we actually went back out to the location and shot more footage, fake footage, just as a joke. And we have like an alternate ending where it's revealed to all be a dream. In spring, there's a fake alternate ending. We got drunk and we took out our iPhones and shot an alternate ending where he's calling his friend back home 9 months later and you know, he's just like, I had a baby and I was not ready and I don't actually really like this girl. I only knew her for a week. The baby's literally a monster. No, literally a monster. He's a monster. You know?
Is Jeremy Gardner on the other end of the call? Because I really want him to be.
He is supposed to be on the other end of the call. Wow. Yes, absolutely.
Sleeping in the dead mother's bed.
Dead. I'm not drunk enough to sleep in your dead mother's bed. Yeah.
And then so for the Endless, we have a whole bunch of them just like that. Can you help me remember these? I'm having trouble. You know what? Get back to me. I'm going to get on my phone while Justin's answering a question.
This is exciting. I'm a little disappointed that it's not a montage of you pointing out ridiculous extras in the background. Look at these ridiculous extras.
Look at this guy. What's up with this guy?
Did you do that for the next disc?
So mean. Considering we probably don't even pay our extras.
No.
But
this is a relatively small cast. I mean, there was maybe, what, like 12, 20 people total?
I mean,
the cult.
Yeah, the cult.
If you take a... whenever you see a wide shot in The Endless and you see other cult members, almost if you, those cult members you're seeing, that is either the script supervisor, the grip team electric, like it's not. Yeah, it's a very, very small cast.
I appreciate that you shot a lot of it outside because no one really understands kind of the trials and tribulations of shooting outside. And the same with Spring and Resolution. You guys have done that a lot. It definitely requires some control. And where did you shoot this, by the way?
We shot it. So I'm guessing everyone here has been to Comic-Con and a lot of listeners have been to Comic-Con. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So Comic-Con in San Diego, if you were to go an hour east of there, there is a little town called Descanso, California.
Hmm.
Most of it's based around there. That's where the camp is at. And then all the other locations are within like 30 minutes of there.
Yeah.
All right. I have the ridiculous extras.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. We're reading.
So when we were casting the movie, we did a lengthy casting session for finding Smiling Dave, who
shockingly
turned out to be played by David Lawson.
Yeah.
And then there was we had a few other people audition for Aaron, Justin, for That's example, yeah. and Dave. They all auditioned for Aaron, so we have those. Vinny Curran, the star of Resolution, he's also in this movie. We asked him to send us pull out his iPhone and record some questions for the behind the scenes, and we just had some kind of boilerplate questions for him.
Right.
He ignored them completely. And as he was getting ready for work and going all the way through a day of work, every like hour or so, he'd pull out his phone and continue this insane story that he started telling us that is nonsense. And it's really wonderful. There's something from what's called the UFO cult comedy. Do you guys know about this?
No.
Okay. So in between Spring and The Endless, we had we did want to try something kind of fresh. So when we knew that we were going to travel the film festival circuit for Spring, we brought a camera and some equipment with us, and we started this movie that was an improvisational comedy called the UFO Cult Comedy that was Justin and Aaron trying to find where the UFO would pick them up in the world because they were raised in that cult. They left, and when they came back, everyone was gone, and they're like, oh no, they ascended without us. And we find out it's just because they thought we were douchebags and they just didn't want, they actually sent us away so that they could ascend without us. And thank you for the pity laughs, guys, but that's why we stopped making it. It was painfully unfunny, and we stopped. So you're going to get to see just how painfully unfunny is.
Wow.
We decided to sacrifice our own ego.
I like the concept of it.
Yeah,
it's a good
fun.
Setup. Man.
Actually, who's in it is Todd Brown. He's in that scene.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, yeah. We got all of our friends to pop up.
Nice. Todd from XYZ.
People always ask us if there's improvisation in our films because the aim is always for the performances to be really naturalistic, and we do all this rehearsal to get it there. The truth is we don't have any improvisation in our films, but we try to do this with improvisation. We are terrible at that. They're just awful. Like, yeah.
I think it takes skill.
Yeah, to be that bad?
Yes.
Skills next.
To improv.
I want to talk a little bit about tone in all three films because that's the thing I always think about your guys' work because I just really respond to tonal consistency, especially when you're shifting tones and gears. And like there's you called the sci-fi, which it is conceptually, but the thing I loved about it and the moments where I was most in, there's one moment that is actually probably my favorite horror moment of the whole year, and it's a part involving you on a rope and pulling something from into the darkness and saying pulling back. And this idea, there's a real specter of Lovecraft. I weirdly enough, I think there's more Lovecraft than this than Spring, and Spring was the one everyone, every single write-up. It's a Lovecraft, and it's like, no, it's a monster movie, but this is like that darkness that is unexplainable and unexplained in the narrative, and I just love how well you guys are able to create those tonal kind of moves. And I think Resolution, you have tonal shifts that are really interesting too, because you go into between comedy and something kind of dark and more menacing. I don't know if there's a necessary question, but I am curious, like what kind of influences you're taking on this one, because it is really unique. I can't think of many movies quite like this in terms of where it goes. It's hard to talk without spoilers, obviously.
Right. Yeah, I can actually say we've been able to piece together what influences have added up to the thing that we do, whatever exactly it is. And before, we weren't really sure of it. It was one day, I think it dawned on us. We're like, oh, that's right. We both read like tons of Stephen King and Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman and you know, if you've ever seen or read House of Leaves, like that kind of a thing. So it's not so much movies. It's more like a literary influence. Yeah, yeah. And all of those people read Lovecraft. We didn't read much Lovecraft, like, but they did. Twilight Zone, The X-Files, that sort of thing. Yeah. But none of those have the tone. And I couldn't really tell you tonally where the influence comes from. Maybe our personalities are just kind of like where that turns into instinct, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, when Resolution first came out and we read reviews of our movies for the first time, it would say genre bending. And now, granted, genre bending is not a synonym for tone. Tone is something more specific. Yeah. But it's related in a way that, yes, our films have humor, they have drama, and hopefully they have scary stuff. The reason why we do that is because what the conversation is how do we make these characters feel like real human beings? And to us, real human beings in stressful situations, there's levity. There's a little bit of humor. Right. Now, if you cross over into like broad comedy, Anchorman, I love Anchorman. Aaron loves Anchorman, probably. But yeah,
I do.
But it doesn't belong in our film, that kind of humor, if you go too far. So, you know, tonally, we try to, we're watching it and we're staying on track. But really, it's about in creating human beings, you must have humor, you must have drama. And hopefully in doing that, if you can get people to really care about the characters, when the scary stuff happens, it has so much more impact than if you just dropped in an archetype and everyone's super serious all the time.
And all three are like world-building, myth-making movies, and that's saying that we don't have enough of now. Like every year I'll see a couple people doing that where they're really creating their own worlds and actual, you know, creatures or characters that have a whole – feel like they have a whole background of myth that could keep going or happened before. Too many movies I feel like you're just cutting in for the horror part they want you to, and then the story's over. And I think that's something like, you know, well, I hope you guys keep at that because I don't know. It's the thing I come back to. Like, I'm itching to see. I've only seen Spring the one time, but often there'll be something in your films I'll be itching to rewatch. And I don't like rewatching many movies, but.
I appreciate that, but also I want that out of my movie watching experience too. You know, I don't think there's any good reason that there's only two or three that try to build a world. And it doesn't have to be Avatar, you know? Yeah, I mean, The Endless has so small of a budget you'd be shocked, and Resolution is in that same universe, and that's a tenth of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and even Jeremy does that a little bit, I think, in The Battery. Like, so you can do it with $6,000.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to stick to whatever that.
Do you know we're producing his next movie?
Yeah, we were there.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that, just being as a company. What is the goal as, I guess, you guys are also producers now as part of the company. Is that saying you guys are looking to do more of it? Is it just saying you wanted to do for your friend? Like, what is the company? Tell us a little bit about.
Yeah. It actually started mostly with Jeremy's movie, you know, Jeremy and Christian's movie, Something Else, just because we heard it was having trouble getting made and we were reading the script. And we read so many scripts. We're sent every single script. Yeah. And I'm sure you guys get past 1,000 scripts too. And everything's just garbage out there, right? And this one was not. It was very clearly not.
It's a really good script.
Yeah. And so we just thought, man, if he will allow us to try it, we would love to give it a shot, to just giving them money and letting them run with it, really. Mm. But you guys had so
much trouble finding money for your own movie. So I was curious, how does that change when you're looking for someone else?
Well, now it's slightly changing. I couldn't find him $5 million. Yeah. You know, that would be troublesome. But I can find him a little bit.
And you guys are letting him shoot in Florida. Like, is his home turf
territory? Well, I'm from Florida, too. Oh. So it's a really good spot. Yeah. And nice. We're getting some support from my old film school and stuff. So
that's really terrific.
Good. Yeah.
And this is a creature feature, right?
Uh-huh.
Excellent. But when your first movie is for $6,000,
there's going to
be a leap no matter what.
Yeah, I feel like Jeremy and Christian are like, so are we going to be able to afford, can I wear like a golden tuxedo every day?
Yeah, I remember being very drunk at Chattanooga, and Christian the entire time, we're stuck in a corner because there was one of those parties.
You remember this?
This was the next day, actually, and all Christian was doing, he kept asking me about camera formats the whole time. And I was just like, oh, I don't know if my brain's up for this conversation, but he kept asking because he was getting nervous about which format.
Post-puke or
I don't remember which puke it was, but it was interesting. But what about what else? So it started that way, and obviously Dave had left Snowfort. Is this saying you guys are looking to do more, like grow this as a company that's producing work, or what's the plan?
Dave will be producing a lot more films than us under the Rustic Films banner. He'll do plenty of stuff that we have nothing to do with at all. Just because we have we're directing, and you know that'll be all consuming. And then on occasion, just when the mood strikes or when the project's right, we'll come in and just help out some people. Mm. You know, we're doing a short with one of our longtime collaborators, Peter Salala. And
he's in my movie. I love Peter.
Isn't he amazing?
He's so fun.
Yeah. And you know, it's going to be something that will come and go. It's a purely passion based thing.
Cool. Yeah.
So I know you guys have a ton of projects that you're working on now. Can you talk about anything? Like, what is next after The Endless?
And what happened to the Aleister Crowley movie? Because that's the one
I
thought that was coming next.
We have the green light to talk about that one.
Because you were close a couple years ago.
Yeah.
What happened was that it was originally, we were employed to write and direct a movie about Aleister Crowley, and that was through the soft money organization in Scotland called Creative Scotland. Uh-huh. And to get paid to do something as an indie filmmaker like that, to develop, unheard of. Like, that was like, and just something so cool, you know, like a 2-hour drama about Aleister Crowley. Yeah. And then when it was completely, the script was done and we started to go out with it, we had just gotten a blind deal with the studio NBC Universal. And they're like, what ideas do you guys have and everything? And we're like, oh, here's the stuff we got. And they're like, that Aleister Crowley thing sounds so cool. So we ended up redeveloping it as a TV show. And that's why it didn't go away. It just took a different form. And we're heading into the final drafts of the pilot. And then, you know, we'll see if it goes to series. But we've been employed for 5 years to write about Aleister Crowley, and that's pretty cool.
That's pretty darn cool. I can now say I feel like I could call myself an expert on Aleister Crowley, although anyone who probably also calls themselves that would school me.
Yeah.
But it takes a huge amount of licenses with his life. Aleister Crowley acolytes will hate this show, but Aleister Crowley would love this show. It uses all of the craziness from his life as fuel for what's happening.
Right.
It's not a big pack of lies or anything like that, but it's also a good story.
Yeah.
So dream casting when you're writing this, even if you could never happen, what is in your mind as you were writing this?
This gets a little esoteric, but do you guys remember a movie called Rock and Rolla? Guy Ritchie's?
Sure. Yeah.
Do you remember is it Johnny Quid? Played by Toby Kebbell, the rock star character.
That's
always been like our archetype of like who he should be. The script in the series itself, it's at its core, it's a 1-hour drama about a really complicated guy.
Yeah.
But like all our stuff, it has a lot of humor, and the type of humor that's there, that's like the perfect comp is Johnny Quid in Rock and Rolla.
I think I remember him from something, that actor.
Yeah. Oh, what you remember him from is Black Mirror.
Black Mirror.
The complete story of your life or history of you or something.
Yeah. The one where they rewind with their eye.
With their eye.
I know Robert Downey Jr. had the rights to that one. I think he was making a movie out of that.
He was also a bad ape.
Dawn
of the Planet.
Yeah, he was in a couple. He was
Warcraft.
Yeah, he was a few motion capture.
Yeah. How 3 movies in, lots of collaboration. How do you guys still complement each other? Has your creative relationship has it grown?
I tell him his shirt looks nice.
Your hair looks good today.
I wish he would mention my
hair. I always tell your bangs look incredible.
No, he's making fun of me. It's actually just gotten better, weirdly enough, you know? Yeah. I mean, we can predict each other pretty damn well. You know, it's funny. We were actually talking about this earlier today, but we don't really argue that much. Interpersonally, we have about one explosive argument about every 6 months, and it's never about film stuff. Yeah. It's just because you do that when you're in a marriage.
I didn't know that was your girlfriend.
Yeah, it's okay, man. It's all right. I mean, now it's our girlfriend. So, but anyways, when we have a disagreement about creative matters, it immediately detaches from a your idea, my idea thing and just becomes an idea. And if we find that we're both just digging in, it only takes us about 5 minutes to realize that's happening now, and we're just like, oh, we haven't found it yet. It's that neither of these ideas are working. We got to find a third idea. Yeah. And that's not compromise, yeah, because we're always, we never say like, all right, you can have this one. You know, it's not like that. It's more that, that very often it's just that that we're both aiming towards the same thing and we're using the wrong tools to get it. And we just got to go grab the right one. And it's cool to realize that. It's cool to actually get better as it goes on. You know, most bands start to disintegrate once they get sick of each
right,
other, you know?
Right, right. What, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I know this is a weird question, but who has been, not including your peers from the festival circuit, something like that, but who's been the most surprising fan of your work? And what I mean by that is also, you know, a lot of comparisons for Spring were like, oh, it's kind of got like a Richard Linklater sort of thing. And then Richard Linklater gave a quote about it, which I thought was amazing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it could be that one, but have there been other filmmakers and people that you guys have kind of grew up respecting and who have been an influence that have seen your work and compliments Amy, yeah.
We've never had this question, and we've been so lucky. A substantial portion of our like childhood heroes we've been able to meet by making films and then having them express their admiration, not the right word, but they say nice things about him. That's good. But so there was Richard Linklater, there was Guillermo del Toro, but most recently,
this is cool.
This is really cool. Mark Danielewski, the author of House of Leaves, came to our premiere night in LA.
Oh, no, wow.
He asked a question during the Q&A. I was so nervous. I had to address it to the audience because my heart was like fluttering trying to answer it. Yeah.
What was the question?
He asked about the insects in the film, the insects and the animals.
Of course.
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
But it was great. Got to actually chat with, you know, one of the best writers in the world there, you know. And actually, the writer of Annihilation, I think, also likes it. Oh, you know what? Actually, he hasn't seen it. He likes Resolution. My bad. But
that
yeah,
doesn't surprise me because there are films about ideas.
They definitely share real estate mm-hmm. there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that's kind of wonderful about the internet. It truly does. I mean, to us, let me use a bad word, but it connects fan and creator because that's what we are. We are such huge fans of House of Leaves and that sort of a thing, and it allows it to just completely turn for just a moment, you know, and that humbles you in an incredible way. Yeah,
that's interesting, that fan and creator now. I mean, like, I see Stephen King interact with so many people, and I'm like,
oh, yeah.
But me, just give one tweet. See me. Stephen King. See, I'm not verified.
He'll see Halloween. He'll see it. You know he will.
But that's not me. No. That's so the Crowley thing, and anything else coming up? That you probably can't.
That's the thing
about.
Is, unfortunately,
but you got stuff. You got irons in the fire.
Yeah. Lots of them.
We're employed to write several TV shows and movies right now. That's a really neat thing. And like,
are you excited? Again, are you excited by the prospect of getting into TV? I mean,
oh yeah. Oh my god, yeah. And again, saying employed sounds like we have like a boss that's like we're doing it for the money. Like it's not that. It's our stuff. Yeah. You know, it's our stuff. We want it to happen.
Right.
But what we mean is we have a there's actual forward momentum. It's not like these pipe dreams. It's like there are things happening, which feels really, really nice.
Yeah.
Would you as directors get back into the super indie, like you were talking about, just taking the reins again and making another small film if things do take too long?
Yeah. I mean, we already have.
Without a doubt.
There's already one in my head that will hammer it out if everything's taking too long and go do another one. And
yeah,
it'll be a slightly bigger scale than The Endless, but something that we can definitely just go do on our own.
Nice.
Cool. Very cool.
So when and where can people see The Endless?
It's still in a few theaters around right now. I don't know when this episode comes out.
Friday.
Oh, okay. So it's still in a few theaters right now. I know, for example, it'll be opening Atlanta and Miami and maybe Boston. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
I think it's still in Toronto. And there's a few smaller markets. It began at the end of March, so it had a pretty healthy small run.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, here's something really cool. This is an indie filmmaker dream that had almost gone away, and it's this. We made a movie that cost nothing. I mean, truly, truly nothing. And it did not get a day and date release. And for, if you know, everyone in this room knows what that is, but it's when you release it on VOD at the same day that you release in theaters.
Yep.
It got our film got an actual limited theatrical release where you could only see our movie in theaters. And I just convinced myself that that was gone. That unless your movie was basically not a big movie necessarily, but it, like minimum Lady Bird, you don't get that.
Mm-hmm.
And Wellgo did it. And that was
such
really
a much
cool.
better
and
way
it did
because
well.
You build anticipation to see it. Like I get so much more excited when I start hearing about a film that I can't see, but if it's VOD and it's a downtown LA, I am definitely watching it on VOD. And it's not because I want to watch it on VOD, it's because it's so much easier. So I love that platforming style.
Yeah.
Wellgo's done that with a couple of films and it feels like it's really respectful for the film. Like I remember they did that with The Wailing last year.
And they did
where
with
Wellgo put it in a couple of films.
Actually, I'm curious about working with Wellgo because before they, I know them because I love Korean cinema and they put out all the Korean movies on Blu-ray. And so when something like the Phantasm collection comes out through them, nobody saw that coming at all. And they're like, really? They're going to do Phantasm? And now, taking your movie on is an unlikely choice for a company that is primarily doing Korean movies. So what was it about them that made them the right choice to put this film out, other than giving you a theatrical, obviously?
Taking it back like a little bit further, we've never made a movie that had distribution in place before its film festival premiere. All three times it's been a situation where it was totally independently made. And the first two movies, again, it was we self-financed it. This one we had an investor, but there was still no distributor. It premieres at a film festival, and then distribution companies come and they bid on the film. So I guess I'm not going to say something as short as they made the highest bid. They truly made it was the best deal. It was they offered the real theatrical and all this stuff. And to be honest, when we premiere films at film festivals and distributors start bidding, we oftentimes don't know the companies that are bidding on it. We just don't follow distribution like that closely. And we're oftentimes educating ourselves on who the companies are like as it's happening. In this case, I think like the clincher was that they offered the theatrical outside of not doing day on day.
Yeah, and I think what they did is, you know, that is definitely bringing Asian cinema to America is and was their specialty. And then what they did is they took all of the goodwill that they built out of that, and they decided to release as kind of a flagship platform something like 2 to 4 independent indies a year. And by the way, I don't speak for them, so I could be getting this wrong, and I'm sorry if you're listening and you work for Wellgo. But they've moved into, ideally, they're like prestige genre American indies, if I'm using the proper phrase. And then they put it out in kind of traditional ways. And they did it with Buster's Malhart, as I was saying. And so we're kind of early in that program. But I think in the coming months and years, Wellgo will be one of those companies that you start seeing that pops up for, around in the same way that like IFC Midnight and A24 and you get it. They all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But mostly picking up movies, not producing them.
I think they're moving into that too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
Well, very cool, guys. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for having
us. If you guys haven't seen it, check out Resolution, Spring and the Endless, and make Resolution and the Endless a nice little pairing.
Yes. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week, guys.
Cheers.